I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, May 21st, 2018. It has been a hell of a few days. On Friday, the Washington Post and the New York Times both reported that a major confrontation had developed between the president, the House Intelligence Committee, and the FBI and Justice Department over information about a source to the early phases of the Russia investigation. Over the weekend, the situation escalated, leading on Sunday to a presidential tweet demanding a Justice Department investigation of infiltration of the Trump campaign. On Monday, the president met with Acting Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, FBI Director Chris Wray, and DNI Coates, and announced a compromise of sorts in which the congressional leadership and the heads of the agencies would sit down to review the material, and the department's inspector general would review the early phases of the investigation. Joining me to thrash through all of this is Bob Bauer, David Chris, and Jack Goldsmith. Where do we start? It's a big mess. David, what are your top line thoughts?
Well, it's certainly a big mess. There are two norms that the president's tweet implicated here. The first is that the White House and the president typically doesn't get involved in directing specific investigations. And the second, and I think it's more important here, is the general conflict of interest standard that the presidents don't go bossing around people with respect to investigations of them or their close associates. And both of these, certainly the latter one about conflicts, I think have, been rolled over here. And I think DOJ has tried to finesse it, as you use that term in The Atlantic, Ben, by giving it over to the IG. I assume it probably would have been within the scope of the IG's mandate anyway for the existing work that he was doing, but tried to make the best of an extremely awkward and difficult situation.
Bob, what are your top line thoughts? You've actually, been a White House counsel. How outlying is this situation?
I'm trying to digest it. Of course, we're seeing all of this develop very quickly. My immediate reaction, which we'll obviously have some time to reflect on until the next bombshell, is that this is a very, very negative development, that we've gone beyond simply the question of whether the president's tweets have become norms to sort of a more formal process by which, if you will, this sort of direction of an investigation, as David outlined it, has been normalized. I mean, it hasn't been completely normalized, but I hear often it said that the lawyers who were involved are making the best of a difficult situation with Donald Trump's excesses having to be handled. But at some point, these compromises are going to begin establishing a road it is going to be difficult to travel back on. And this is a very aggressive step that I think from a strategic and other perspective is, if you want to look at it this way, darkly a victory for Donald Trump and what he's been trying to do for some time with the department. I think it's damaging to the department. And I think, frankly, the congressional role as well in all of this is exceedingly disturbing.
Jack, what are your top line thoughts?
So I agree that it's a bad development. I agree that the president has crossed a new line by this tweet order. The tweet itself didn't demand an investigation. It demanded that the department look into this matter to see not whether there were any improper surveillance. It was kind of a softball, and it was easy for the deputy attorney general to send it to the inspector general. It definitely crosses the line of the president getting involved, the norm line, not the legal line, of the president getting involved in an ongoing investigation of himself and his associates in a way that can be seen as politicizing it and as trying to turn it and investigate the investigators. But on the other hand, I find this in some sense less problematic than some of his more overt threats that he's going to fire people and attacking their integrity. And the accommodation with the inspector general seems, if the president's satisfied with that, seems like a potentially useful way to resolve this and, hopefully could credibly reject the president's insinuations if the inspector general is in a much better position to credibly reject the president's insinuations than, say, if the House Intelligence Committee had done this. On Bob's point about the damage, I have no doubt that this is corroding and that Trump is corroding his relations with the Justice Department. I'm not sure if Bob meant there would be long-term damage to White House DOJ relations. I think that's hard to know. The thing I find most troublesome about all this is not the order to look into the surveillance of the Trump campaign, but rather the accommodation this afternoon that the president may in effect be ordering the disclosure of an FBI confidential source. That really crosses FBI lines. They really care a lot about protecting their sources, both for their credibility with that source and future sources. And it's pretty outrageous that the president may be pressuring them to disclose information about, that informant, I should have said. So that's the piece of this that I find the most troubling.
So as these remarks reflect, there are two elements of the compromise today. One is the referral to the Inspector General. The other is the accommodation on the information that Nunes sought. I want to talk about them separately because they seem to me to be different. I'm genuinely uncertain how to understand the IG thing. One way to understand it is it's a clever finesse by Rod Rosenstein. The president thought he was demanding an investigation, and Rosenstein kind of kicks it to the IG. The president today seems to accept that, and so you have elided the apparent demand to launch an unpredicated criminal investigation, right? The whole implication of the president's tweet, right, is that there's some illegal spying on his campaign, and it's outrageous, and this is what they should be investigating, and he's going to demand that they investigate it. And so Rod Rosenstein says, oh, we'll kick it over to the IG and look, and thereby sort of deflates this particular balloon. And you can say, and a lot of people, Marty Lederman and Steve Vladek on Twitter have been giving him a lot of credit. The other way to understand it, which others have been arguing, is wait a minute. The president of the United States called up an investigation of his investigation on the basis of essentially no evidence of any impropriety, and he got it. And we should be horrified by that. And I'm curious which account is the right one, or maybe I'm tempted by the idea that both of them are right.
Well, if I could just very briefly say, and I think Jack asked the right question, is this sort of a moment in time well handled by Rosenstein, or is this a problem for the long run, that we ought to separate out the criticism of Rosenstein from simply the fact that it happened. Rosenstein's stuck, let's say, with some very difficult alternatives. He makes the best of a situation he should not have to face, but now it's done. And in the same period of time in which the White House clearly collaborated with the Hill to push on the disclosure of the intelligence source, the president also winds up demanding an investigation that clearly directly concerns him, an investigation of his investigation, and he gets what he wants, at least in part. In fact, if I were a diabolical counsel to the president and he turned to me and he asked me, should I accept this offer? I would tell him to take it in a nanosecond. It's the best he can do in the circumstances. So without assuming that Rosenstein made the wrong call here by any means, given the choices he faced, I see this as having crossed a line. And once these lines are crossed, they are, if you will, it's a practice underlying which is an argument that the president has repeatedly made about his control of DOJ that will not be lost on future administrations should we have presidents who are similarly inclined.
David, what do you think? Is this handling it cleverly? Is it a bad precedent? Is it both?
I do think it's both. I think it is, you know, bad that the president tweeted and demanded what he demanded. I think that given that that happened, Rosenstein made the best of a bad situation. You know, another way of putting it is that American core institutions and norms of democracy are resilient, and they can, in the hands of smart people like Rod Rosenstein, you know, survive assault. But the larger point is that they ought not to be assaulted in this way.
What do you think, Jack? One of the questions that I'm struggling with here is whether, you know, I was thinking about this today, is there any real history of kicking crazy conspiracy theories to an inspector general by way of making them go away? I mean, usually when there are allegations and you kind of kick them to an IG, it's because there's something kind of plausible about them and you kind of want to put them to rest.
I don't think we've got the example of the Page FISA investigation. I think that was exactly what you just described. That was kicked to the inspector general, probably on the theory that they needed a way to investigate it, that they, the people, the political appointees and the people involved in the Mueller investigation were seen by many to be have an interest in that question. So you had to find a neutral observer that I assume will vindicate the department. And I assume that's what they thought when they referred it to him. So I think that's an example. And there are others, I think.
Others predating this administration, or is this a mechanism that we're developing in order to diffuse kind of presidential temper tantrums?
First of all, so I don't think we can, I think it's a mistake. I don't think we can know, but I think it's a mistake to think that any precedent set in the Trump administration is going to outlast the administration any more than any of Richard Nixon's norm violations outlasted his. I'm skeptical that they will, but I think it's, if I'm wrong, I might be wrong, but I think it's a mistake to assume that the crazy things Trump is doing are going to have to outlive his administration. And if anything, I predict that there will be a backlash just like there was after Nixon. So I just think it's too hard to predict what's going to happen after Trump. I think we can try to figure out what's going on here. And I agree with David and Bob that this is Trump crossing a line, but he's been crossing a line. He's been crossing these lines between the White House and the Justice Department, between the president and law enforcement, but in violating the lines of independence of the Justice Department for over a year now in ways that are, I think, equally egregious as what happened in the tweet yesterday. So we're in this situation. All right. It's a regrettable situation, but it is what it is. The president's been doing this for a long time. And yes, there are accommodations being made. Yes, they are unhappy accommodations. But the main point is the reason Rosenstein made this accommodation is because he's got his eyes on the prize, which is the Mueller investigation that he's trying to protect.
All right. So let's talk about the other element of the compromise, which is that the statement is a little bit ambiguous about what's going to happen, but it basically says that the Justice Department, the FBI, the DNI, and the congressional leadership will sit down under the auspices of the White House Chief of Staff, Kelly, and will review the documents that the congressional leadership has demanded. It doesn't say that they'll get them. It doesn't really quite even say that Congress will have access to them, but that is sort of the implication. And so my question is, if this whole confrontation is about whether Devin Nunes gets access to information about a confidential informant who helped the Bureau in the early phases of the Russia investigation and has a long relationship with U.S. intelligence, according to the press, isn't this a big win for Devin Nunes?
Well, I'll take a crack at that if you'd like. I think that it is. I mean, he is somebody who, for most of the time that we've been dealing with this Russia investigation, has conducted himself in a way that has robbed him of any credibility. Here he is now in the middle of things with, frankly, what I think is an outlandish demand that is being catered to. And that brings me just very quickly to the congressional side of this, which I mentioned earlier. I think we ought to consider when we talk about what will happen to this norm, sort of how this episode will be remembered, what echo we may hear from it in the years ahead, that the president has had the collaboration of the majority party in the Congress in this intercession in an ongoing investigation. He's been bolstered by someone like Devin Nunes. And there are levels of complicity, by the way, in the congressional leadership. Not everybody is Devin Nunes, to be sure, but I do consider this to be a win for him. I think it's a win for the president. I think it sets a terrible precedent for the role that Congress can have in politicizing an ongoing investigation and without anything approaching a foundation demanding access to information that the intelligence community and the FBI has told them they should not have for fear of endangering an important intelligence source.
David, I don't really understand the answer to this because I've never been in the middle of the streams of information that flow between the executive branch and the oversight committees in the intelligence sphere. In your experience, do you know of prior instances in which the intelligence committees have wanted specific information about confidential informants? And in those situations, do we normally see some kind of accommodation reach, or do we normally see the executive branch say, no way, no how?
I don't want to say that the names of confidential human sources or secret agents are never disclosed, because history is long. But it is definitely way outside the norms to start giving the names of informants or sources to the committees. The legal standard for briefing them is that they are to be kept fully and currently informed. That's not a self-defining phrase, but it has long been understood generally not to include that kind of information. I couldn't say that it's never been done and an accommodation's never been reached, but it's certainly outside the norm and extremely unusual if it's ever done.
Is it ever even sought?
It's not something that, you know, sort of polite conversation admits, at least in almost any instance that I can ever think of. And so we are well outside, in my experience, the norms and the understandings that have grown up between the branches as they have struggled from time to time with one another, the legislative and executive branches. But this has been kind of a red line that I don't remember being crossed. You know, again, I can't say never, never, but it is certainly well outside anything in my experience. And, you know, there's another norm that's related to this on the sort of criminal side, which is the opening of ongoing law enforcement investigative files, which is another one where historically there have really been some hard lines drawn by the Department of Justice. And both of those understandings are being breached here. I mean, to give it sort of, I'm trying to imagine the most charitable way of thinking about it. And I suppose one could say, look, the understanding and accommodation tactics between the branches of government could shift, and it would be probably within the power of the president to shift the way that the executive branch responds to oversight requests and when it pushes back and when it doesn't. It would be a radical change. But it would be a shift that could be made. But again, what's so problematic here is that it's occurring in the context of a case in which the president is obviously burdened by a massive conflict of interest. You know, I think our system of separated powers is designed to deal with a healthy tension between legislative and executive branches that sometimes is moderate, sometimes flares up. But it strikes me that it is not as well designed to deal with what we have here, which is a schism within the executive branch between the White House and the law enforcement agencies, in which the White House is allied with and possibly using members of Congress as a kind of a cat's paw to get information through a radically expanded oversight approach that is, again, well outside our historical norms in a case that is obviously of great personal interest to the president. There is something really, really screwy about that.
Can I add something to that?
Yep.
So I agree completely with what David said, and it really is the combination of the Intelligence Committee meddling in a very intensive, fine-grained way in an ongoing investigation, and then on top of that, wanting access to information about the source. But the really weird thing that David's comments made me think of is that I've made this point many times before, people are tired of hearing it, but the reason the president is having to kind of use the House Intelligence Committee to pressure the Justice Department is because he can't do it himself. They have exercised really extraordinary independence. And yes, he's chiseling it away, and yes, he's forcing them to make accommodations. But if you think about it, the weirdness that David described is because, you know, normally we think of a president able to get his way in the executive branch. And here, over and over again, he's not been able to get his way on the fundamental issue of the Russia investigation, which has been bugging him for a year now. And so in a way, and I completely agree, it's entirely weird to have a Republican Congress demanding information from the Justice Department. The Justice Department, of course, is not going to turn over this type of information without a big fight. But to have the president on the side of Congress and to have against his own Justice Department is entirely weird. But it really is a testament to how much they have withstood his direct pressure, I think.
You know, Jack, can I just follow on that? Because I agree with you that the president's choice of tactics here reflects a choice not to engage directly with DOJ and simply demand that they open their files to him. But I am not as sanguine that that's not the trend that we're seeing and that we may not be there in reasonably short order, because he has said in a number of his tweets, I'm not exercising my authority to do this or that, but I have the authority. And he's using Congress now to get the stuff, or trying to. But then if you put that together with the direct order on the IG investigation that we talked about earlier, I can see some incremental movement towards, you know, the next logical extension, which is the direct demand to see all the evidence against him.
Yes, I agree. I completely agree, and I'm not sanguine about this. I'm just, my only point was really that part of the weirdness of this is the president trying to find a strategy of using Congress to get at his remarkably independent Department of Justice. And I completely agree that everything that's happened the last two or three days is chiseling away at that. And Rosenstein appears to be making strategic or tactical choices, I guess, about what he can give up. You know, if the president wants to give up the crown jewels of the executive branch to Congress, he's allowed to do that. We've never had a president that wanted to do that. That's right. His prerogative.
Wait, let's pause over that for a second, because I was trying to imagine this meeting today, right? I mean, so the meeting develops, presumably because there's a congressional demand for information that the Justice Department and the FBI take the position, no way, no how. It gets elevated to the level of the president, not the White House, but the president personally. So they get summoned to the meeting with the president, who then instructs the executive branch to accommodate the legislature on the no way, no how material in some way. I'm interested in the question of whether the sole legal authority to withhold that information is the president. That is this is the president's information. He's either going to assert some form of privilege over it ultimately, or it gets given over in some way, or whether there's something about the nature of the information they're required to provide. That is to say, you know, they're required to brief on, you know, on intelligence activities, that they're not even required to give this information in the first place, but the president is instructing them to do it. Is this material that's either privileged or Nunes gets it, or is there some other basis to withhold it?
This may not answer you, but and I'm glad we have both Bob and Jack on the line, who probably have a deeper insight. But I mean, I think the executive branch at least takes the position that the statutory requirements, such as they are, including the fully and currently informed briefing standard, doesn't reach as far as we're being asked to reach in this instance. And they think that there are constitutional underpinnings to that within separation of powers and the Article II power that the president enjoys. But I don't think there's much precedent in the executive branch for thinking, by way of example, if this is what you're driving at, that the attorney general could prevent the disclosure of information to Congress, which the president wanted him to disclose. Certainly executive privilege, I think, is something that is understood to be personally asserted by the president or not at all. In Fast and Furious, for example, Eric Holder didn't assert privilege. He asked President Obama to do so. President Reagan had a policy of personally being the one to assert executive privilege. And I think also with respect to the sort of more general stuff that isn't subject to privilege, if the president, as the head of the executive branch, wants to give it up, I don't believe any of his subordinate officers could be in a position to refuse, unless there is some statutory prohibition on its production, which I don't think there is.
To clarify, I mean, I'm trying to understand the underlying law of this. And what I take it you're saying, David, is that there's no statutory requirement in the executive branch's view to turn over material like this. But if the president wants to, no subordinate officer gets to say, well, we don't have to turn that over, right? So if you're sitting in a meeting and you're Rod Rosenstein and the president says, give it to Devin Nunes, that's kind of the end of the conversation, right?
I mean, I think so. The tricky part here, as I've said, is the conflict of interest. But in normal situations, yeah, I think that's right. I welcome different views from serious constitutional scholars, but that's my sense of it.
In that case, I yield to Jack. My understanding is the same as David, but subject to Jack's views on, I would have given the same answer.
Me too. I mean, I don't actually know. I should know, but I don't. What the legal basis is for not turning over information in ongoing criminal investigations. I don't, you know, even with the duty to disclose to the intelligence committees, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but even the duty to disclose, to keep the intelligence communities informed about ongoing intelligence operations or whatever the statutory language is, they don't reveal sources. They never, I don't think, in my experience, ever reveal sources in that. They just kind of give them the information they need to know what the intelligence operation is. I don't actually know what the technical legal basis is for not turning over information in ongoing criminal investigations, but I know that that's the Justice Department's position. And I agree with David and Bob that it's the president's call. All of this stuff is the president's call. Congress has not regulated it in any relevant way. And the president can order the Justice Department. And of course, his subordinates can resign if they want, and they may. But he can order them to turn over any of this information. It's just completely bizarre. It's so far beyond the realm of what we've come to think about the presidency to have the president of the United States blowing a source in a counterintelligence investigation.
Yeah.
And of course, it's even more bizarre because he's blowing the source in a counterintelligence investigation of his campaign.
And I would suggest, by the way, also that to evaluate this, what this means over the long term, which is a topic we've come back to a couple of times, I'd like to talk for a minute about where we started and where we are right now. If I were tracing the trajectory here, it would be from a president who at one point said, well, I know I can't control the Department. I thought I could control the Department of Justice. I thought it was mine, but apparently it's not. And then over time, as the tweeting became more intense and the Republican clamor in his support became louder, we have been moving toward the point where we are here, where the president convenes a meeting, just openly, flagrantly, in a matter that involves them, a meeting, and pressures his own department to reach an accommodation with congressional Republicans about, as we said, both an intervention in an ongoing criminal investigation and an intervention that may involve disclosing an intelligence source. So over time, we have been creeping in a direction here that I just think is extraordinarily disturbing. And it may be that it's because the investigation is heating up and the president's lost his patience, having been told it was going to end. It may have something to do with midterms and the narrative that the Republicans are trying to construct about the president being victimized. It may be they're trying to set up a bit of a ramp to what they expect the IG to disclose in the Comey report that is McCabe report that is apparently, you know, shortly to be released. I don't know. But the trajectory is a very bad one.
I agree that it's a bad one, but this is the point that you and I have debated for almost a year now. It's a bad one within the Trump administration, that the trend is in a negative direction, no doubt about that. But we can no more infer a negative long-term impact on DOJ White House relations from these trends than we could have predicted it based on the unbelievably corrupt things Nixon did with his Justice Department.
We have debated it, and I constantly, you know, reconsidering my view here and trying not to overreact, but it's very easy to do. So I think your point is very well taken. The one thing I just want to note here is, or that continues to give me considerable pause, is that modern American presidents have been very, very uneasy for a variety of reasons about the independence of the Department of Justice. The independent counsel statute obviously brought that to a head in a number of respects. And the tendency on the part of the executives to want to protect themselves from this, either by the appointments they made or by the control that they can exercise over the investigation, is, I think, fairly powerful. And I think that tendency outlasts even the reckless applications of it that we see in Trump's case, gives a president so inclined a little bit more covering fire in the future, only because that underlying dynamic for the institution, I think, is going to be roughly the same.
Just to try to answer Ben's question, I mean, my understanding, and there's actually a Lawfare post I did on presidential norms on this, that DOJ's explanation for why they don't give up open investigation files is set forth in this so-called Linder letter, a letter they wrote to Representative John Linder in the year 2000. And it's not a strict statutory or legal basis. It's a norms-based restriction with roots in separation of powers, both limits on congressional oversight authority and the prerogatives of the executive branch under Article II. With respect to classified information, which an informant's identity might very well be, they have taken the position in briefs filed in the Supreme Court that didn't result in a decision on the merits, but nonetheless reflect the executive branch's view in the 1980s, that the president does control classified information, including its distribution to Congress. But again, that's the president, not the AG, when the president wants to give it up. So that's at least my understanding of the core legal framework.
Right. So this stuff is arguable. Problem is certainly not covered by the affirmative obligations to disclose, but it's also not privileged. And even if it were privileged, the president is perfectly entitled to give it up anyway. And beyond that, he's just entitled to do what he wants. If he wants to give information to Devin Nunes, he's allowed to.
Yeah. I mean, except for the conflict of interest issue here, that's right. If you imagine this playing out in a different setting, you know, say Fast and Furious or some other context where the president and the White House aren't personally implicated in any way, you know, there's going to be some behind the scenes back and forth between the White House and the Justice Department, even about the scope of executive privilege that's going to be asserted. And maybe the Justice Department is going to want a broad assertion and the White House is going to say, no, we're not going that broad, you know, work with our friends in Congress and we'll give you a narrow assertion of privilege if you really need it in the end, but don't make the president do this if you don't have to. And, you know, those kinds of conversations are routine and non-corrupt. What's weird here is that this is an investigation of the Trump campaign and possibly the president himself.
Before we wrap up, I want to talk about the role of the press here. This was an odd situation in which the Washington Post and New York Times both disclosed a lot of information about the identity of the source, but not the name, having been prompted to do so by the president's own misrepresentations about the individual. That is, that he was an embedded source within the Trump campaign. The New York Times ran its story in order to rebut effectively a presidential tweet, and had been withholding all this information for some time before that. The press got a lot of criticism during the Snowden period for being too quick to blow classified programs. Here we have the odd counterexample of the press being more reticent than either the House Intelligence Committee or the president himself, and functioning in an effective alliance with the Bureau and the Justice Department.
I wouldn't go that far. I found that the press's professions of self-virtue on this a little hard to take. They described in very concrete detail who that person was. And it made it possible for anyone with any information to figure out exactly who his identity was. They just didn't name his name. And for all intents and purposes, they identified the person. I don't know whether
they're... Well, but hang on.
Go ahead.
But hang on a second. Because that was only after the president tweeted false information about who the person was and what role he was playing. And they had a lot of that information for a while and hadn't run it. It was only when the president said, you know, the FBI put a source inside the Trump campaign, that the New York Times then went with the story in order to correct what the president was saying.
Did they have to mention that he was a professor who was a former intelligence agent who was living in England to achieve that goal?
My point wasn't about the level of detail that they released. My point was about the essential restraint in the first instance in not publishing it at all.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I don't think they showed much restraint. By the time they gave a very, I'm not criticizing them. I guess I'm criticizing their professions of restraint and virtue. They described who that person was so that it could be figured out. That's all I'm saying.
What do Bob and David think on this?
Well, I mean, I know that when I saw the New York Times or the Post story referring to this guy as a professor who had served in two prior administrations, I typed into my search bar, professor in England who searched in two prior administrations, and immediately went to the prior article, I believe it was in BuzzFeed, that named him. So I was able to connect those dots pretty quickly at that point. So I don't think not naming him when they did publish did much good, given what was already out there and the mosaic that could be constructed even by, you know, a relatively unsophisticated folk like me. I don't know whether the delay in publishing it, I think, is perhaps an evidence of restraint. But once they went with something, they more or less did allow him to identify.
That's the point I was making.
I agree with that. I mean, I think given that they're a news organization, given the pace of events and how organizations respond to those competitive pressures and their professional standards, they probably did as well as they thought they could do. I think at the end of the day, what most strikes me is that this phase of the public communications war that the president and his allies are waging is one that they're winning. And so these stories can run with denunciations of his violation of norms and the identification of falsehoods in what he says. But so far, the White House on this one has built a narrative that I think they're probably pretty satisfied with. And the president is engaged in an unprecedented intervention. And I don't know that the people that he hopes to, shall we say, appeal to with this behavior, the narrative he hopes to sell here, you know, I don't think they're going to be troubled by it at all.
But may I just say one thing to that? The president is definitely winning on this particular tactic, but whether he's winning or not depends on what Mueller's doing. And what Rosenstein is doing is playing for time so that Mueller can finish his work. So I think we can't tell if the president, he may be winning on this short-term tactical point, but whether the president's winning or not depends entirely, I think, on what Mueller is doing.
You know, and Jack, that makes me sort of think about something you said earlier in this podcast and something you've said long before that, I think, both of which I think are right, which is these behaviors and tactics by Trump will ultimately be viewed by future presidents, members of Congress, and others in hindsight. And a lot will depend on how it ends up for him. Because right. If he gets away with it and if he benefits from it, then the tactics will be recycled and used by others who expect the same. If he ends up, you know, destroyed or damaged, then people may think twice about engaging in this kind of norm busting because they may associate the norm busting with the bad outcome the president ultimately faced.
Agree.
I agree with only this one caveat, and I don't mean to express it overly strongly, but I would distinguish between the president's potential for grotesque overreach and reckless application with a bad outcome that will make it look like in hindsight he is lost. But there are more refined applications of this episode that people who are more adept than his team might find useful in the future, given, as I said earlier, the tension that has existed between the White House and the Department of Justice in the modern presidency since Watergate, and which I think, as I said earlier, I think we're seeing a bad trajectory on.
Yeah.
But it depends on what ultimately, as in Watergate, it really depends on what comes next. If Trump is reelected in 2020 and these tactics are seen as to not prevent him from winning a reelection, that's one thing. If he's repudiated in the midterms and in the next election, and if the people in hindsight see this as inappropriate behavior, as I believe that the majority will, I don't think the things you're concerned about, we'll see, Bob, I don't think that they're going to come to pass.
For each of you, before we wrap up, how stable is the compromise that was apparently reached in the White House today? David?
Not stable, because in that meeting, Nunes will continue to press, Justice will continue to resist, and then John Kelly or whoever it is going to have to make the call. And also tomorrow, there's going to be some new outrageous thing that goes on. So even if this particular compromise lasts, you know, there's going to be another problem before you can say Jack Robinson.
Jack, how stable is the compromise?
I think not stable for all the reasons David said. And I mean, nothing about President Trump is stable, and he could, you know, he says one thing one day and he could go off on a different tangent tomorrow. There's no agreement that he makes or that he abides by that lasts more than a couple of days. So I don't think it's stable at all. On the other hand, you could see this as another round of making a big deal out of something. Oh my God, they're about to have a, we're about to have a constitutional crisis, and it goes away. But I don't think we should see this as any kind of stable solution.
Bob, any chance of stability?
No, I don't. I agree with everything that's been said, and I would add to that, there is a chance, and this happens often enough, that having seen this work up to whatever point they think it's worked, Nunes and company will push toward instability in the sense that they will drive for more. Maybe they'll overplay their hand, maybe they won't, but that will be another potential source of instability.
Bob Bauer, David Chris, Jack Goldsmith, thanks for joining us. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast. Apologies for the audio quality. If this were a normal edition of the Lawfare podcast, you would now be hearing Sophia Yan, our pianist, play the music, but we don't do that. It is, however, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and we need your support to promote it because otherwise people don't learn about the Lawfare podcast. So right now, while it's still fresh in your mind, share it on Facebook, tweet it, pin it on Pinterest, whatever social media systems you use, and please go to Apple Podcasts or the podcast distribution service you use and leave us a rating and a review. And as always, thanks for listening.